Jaiguru, everyone.
Jaiguru. Jaiguru. And welcome to Yogananda Podcast, Chapter 10, Part 5 is where we are. So I think we're probably halfway through. Just so you know, this will be over halfway through this chapter now. We're getting to a very juicy part of the chapter that really has been a big build-up in Yogananda's life. You know, this is somewhat of a long wait for Yogananda. And we'll cover the very beginning of that meeting between himself and his great guru today. So we are down Lauren, by the way, for any viewers, any eagle-eyed viewers. Lauren is not with us today, but we do have the lovely Priyank and Mike with us, so the trio back. So hopefully Lauren will be back with us for the next episode. But for anybody that's maybe reading along with us, please do start from the soul treasure, which had accompanied me from Calcutta all the way down to a few eager steps, and I was at his feet. So you can pause, read along, and any sort of inputs or, you know, anything you think that we might miss, please do jump in and add them into the discussion on the forums. So yeah, we can jump straight into it then. The first part that we have to talk about is this soul treasure that Yogananda mentions. And I thought, first and foremost, here's Yogananda saying that this soul treasure that had accompanied him from Calcutta to Benares, or where he is at the moment, is the silver amulet that bequeathed him to him from his mother, from the sadhu. And we can cast our minds back to chapter 2, and we covered it in the fourth part of that chapter, where we looked at this in a lot more detail, and we can go into that in a little bit more detail as a refresher today. But I thought, wow, this is his soul treasure. This is the one thing that I really brought with him. You know, he didn't bring much worldly possessions, and I'm sure his father was able to maybe give him more worldly possessions to make his journey a bit more comfortable, or his time there a bit more comfortable. But he didn't have that. He says his soul treasure was this amulet. So that just talks to the importance that Guruji really placed on that, the faith and the devotion, which I think is somewhat of a theme in, should be a theme in this episode. But I thought it was lovely there, the first moments, you can see how much he valued this amulet. Rick?
Well, if I had this amulet, it would probably be my greatest treasure as well. Wouldn't it be yours? Magically manifested. And the story was obviously equally phenomenal.
For sure.
And it looks like it's a bit of a ritual already, that every now and then when he needs to kind of feel, or kind of when he forgets the meaning of the amulet, he just goes to his attic or goes to his room, opens it up again, and has a look at it, and it has an effect on him. So I feel like that's what he was about to do as well this time, something that he is doing frequently.
Yeah. I mean, for anybody who's needing a refresher on this, chapter 2, part 4, that we covered it, excuse me, I'm still choking on some coughs, was that this silver amulet was given to him by his brother Ananta, who in turn was it was given to him by his mother, who in turn it was given to her by a sadhu. And the sadhu really said that it was going to be of great importance, that Mukunda would know what importance it would have, and the meaning, and it was given to him by the great ones. So Yogananda said that the amulet was like a spiritual yeast that was silently working within him, and that he hoped amid the Himalaya snows that the masters whose face had often appeared to him in visions would come into reality. So Yogananda had obviously been really attuned with this amulet. And like I said, guys, like, this is a pretty significant item in his possession. And he's hidden it in his room in the ashram. Now, we talked about back in chapter 2, what form would this amulet come in? And we sort of fantasized about the size and what it might look like and these things. But we actually have some of the answer here. And And Yogananda says that there is a sealed box, a locked box that he put in a sealed covering. And within that, the amulet was in an envelope. So in this passage here, what Yogananda is telling us is that, it's going to be big enough to fit or small enough to fit into this envelope. So we know roughly what sort of size it would have been. So we can start to what it might have looked like, which, you know, it's nice to do.
Mm-hmm.
And here we have Yogananda had guarded it for years, he says. So he had really hidden it carefully in the ashram. And upon having some difficulties in the new ashram where he was, he had sought out his talisman, and he had gone to his room, and one morning he had went to open this lockbox, and the seal covering was untouched. And sorry, before I jump into it, Mike, do you want to jump in with a comment?
I was just speculating. So we know it's flat, the amulet, right? So it has to be flat, otherwise it doesn't fit in an envelope.
What do you mean? It doesn't fit well in an envelope, but it still fit in an envelope.
Yeah, right, sure. But I imagine it now. I feel like it's flat and probably some kind of shape. Maybe it's round, or maybe it's the shape of a lotus flower or something. What kind of image comes to your mind when you think of it?
I'm thinking it's like, you know, there's something that doesn't fit in an envelope well. So it's like creates a small
like
bulge.
A bulge. Okay.
And of course, okay. It could, like, he doesn't say how big his how big the box was that he was putting it in. Like, could be a huge, could be a chest of, like, a huge treasure chest. And his envelope could be in, like, A1 sized envelope. No. I think he said it fits in his hand and it was something along those lines.
I'm going to say as well, given the importance of the item, I don't think Guruji would have it crushed into some sort of envelope, like, kind of wrapped around it, you know. If it was a substantial size or not flat, I think
you don't know Indians very well, do you? We make anything and everything work.
if the cube roughly fits, is that the saying? Yeah. Okay. So we have some debate then on this, but
you thought it was concluded.
The audience could let us know what they think, but my thesis here is that it fits neatly into an envelope of a fairly neat size, because he carried it around with him in a box. So I doubt this was some sort of, you know, gargantuan thing that he was carrying around on top of his luggage and things like this that he probably had. So there you go. I'm going to say it's 2-1. So, you know,
although we got another clue. Dayananda said that your father sending you look too much cash. So with all that cash you're sending me, he must have had a big box to, like, keep all his cash. So it could have been a massive box.
You're planting doubt in the mind, not correct.
He wasn't wearing it all the time. So maybe it was uncomfortable to wear because it's too big.
Weighing him
or if you want to keep something safe, do you wear it or do you keep it somewhere at home? I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, either way, I'm sure he kept it in very good condition, no matter what physical shape that it had. So he had.
You don't know Indians very well, do you, Chris? my bangle is so scratched; it's unreal. That's my most prized possession.
Well, this item, to go back to it, this sealed covered item, it was untouched, Guruji says, in this box. And it was sealed and kept nicely, the envelope was there. And he goes to open it, and he finds that he said he tore open the envelope and it was gone. The amulet was not there. So this scene that we're having unfolded before us is something of a mixed, you know, mixed signal, isn't it? Is it a good moment? Is it a, you know, a moment that brings stress to Guruji? He quickly follows it up to say, you know, it had vanished in accordance with the Sadhu's prediction, into the ether once he had summoned it. It's a lovely sort of poetic way to finish that off. So he doesn't really speak too much to how he was feeling at that time, but evidently you would imagine he's recognized that, okay, well, the amulet served its purpose. And as the Sadhu said, that Guruji or young Mukunda would know its purpose. So I think actually in this moment, he was probably feeling quite uplifted in some way. I think, okay, well, he might be getting near to his lifelong dream of meeting his guru and meeting one of these masters. So we could speculate that much, I think, on this moment. Sorry, Mike, jump in.
But he was still in Dayananda's ashram. So it could have, like, maybe his first thought was, maybe that's it. Maybe I'm in the right place. Or am I in the right place? Maybe that's kind of, maybe the thought that came into his mind, the amulet is gone. So am I in the right place here or not? What's going on?
That's true. He was having a lot of difficulties, wasn't he? He was having some friction, which we're about to talk into. And he clearly knew that he wasn't in the right place. I think his heart was yearning for something else. So he says here that his relationship with the Dayananda's followers grew steadily worse. This short paragraph here is actually really punchy when you read it. You know, he's really not holding back from describing the scenes at the time. He talks about being alienated. He says that he had hurt the household through his determined aloofness, his strict adherence to meditation, and the very ideal for which he had left his home, and all the worldly ambitions called forth a shallow criticism. So he had been criticized, it says, by all sides for his routine, essentially his spiritual routine, his sadhana. And this much he makes very clear, that there was clashes of this ongoing routine. And Paramahansa Yogananda really insists on the importance of routine and doing, never missing your sadhana, never missing your meditations. Mm-hmm. So I thought, you know, even the words of determined aloofness, it's quite funny, isn't it? In a sense, he's a very stubborn individual in the right way. You know, he doesn't shift his meditation practice for somebody else's that he thinks is inferior.
He says it's what he left his home for. So he really knows what he wants. He expected an ashram where there is a meditation routine going on, and that doesn't seem to be the case. Instead, he gets ridiculed for it.
Yeah. I think it was tough enough for him, wasn't it, in his home, where, you know, he often escaped to the attics, and sometimes, you know, he had his household duties and things like this, and he would want to remain in meditations. And there were some moments where, you know, he and his friend, he said he had often times difficulties with meditation. So it wasn't exactly accepted everywhere, you know, to just meditate all the time that Guruji wanted to do. You know, you do have your tasks and chores in life. And whenever he's obviously now away with a larger group of individuals, you all have to chip in with the chores. They probably felt he wasn't doing his part, you know. That's one of the practical challenges of the spiritual path. But certainly with the way that Dayananda's followers, you know, they practice their sadhana, it was different.
Have you guys ever been criticized for meditating too much by people? I remember my family member, once, I think my father-in-law as well, he said you shouldn't meditate too much, like you become, I can't remember what word he says, but he was advising not to meditate too much. And I was like, that's against the advice of my guru.
Yeah. Is he on a different path as such, where he thinks we're in a different yuga?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah. So he thinks probably more. He's,
yeah. Prayer. Yeah. He's lost faith in faith. recently.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you're in a social setting, you know, you've got a partner or something, you need to try to work out the best times to do everything, and one is definitely meditation. So, you know, there is that much. I have, you know, awkwardly chosen a time to meditate when it should have been, you know, socializing time, and meditation come before that sometimes. Yeah, gotten in trouble on more than one occasion. But, but good kind of trouble, welcomed trouble in some way. Like,
yeah, when you travel with people who don't have a meditation routine, then find the evening is always easier, because when you all go to sleep, you just meditate. But the morning, I'm not the guy who gets up at 5 to, or something. So it usually shows that, where's Michael? Like, yeah. So, but it's not too bad. Most of my friends, they know me already.
He's at it again. At it with God.
That's what they say. Yeah. Like,
I think, yeah. I personally think it's like probably one of the worst forms of criticisms that I can take. Something that goes directly against what you pretty much made the goal of your life. Really tough, isn't it?
Everything else becomes an obstacle in some, if you're not careful. Yeah, but Yogananda did mention about balancing family responsibilities and everything, right? So I think he would be he's a pragmatic individual at times as well. We're not seeing it right now in this moment of his life. But there is a balance there for sure. He does say it was really tough for him. He says this is torn by spiritual anguish. He entered into his attic one dawn to resolve to pray until his answer was vouchsafed. So he is really looking for an answer as to why he's really going through this really difficult time, and he prays again to Divine Mother. And there's an amazing part in this chapter that we're just about to read. But I'll jump to you, Priyank, first.
Yeah, it must be, you know, he's getting criticism from a spiritual ashram environment. So for us to get it from our friends and family or colleagues or acquaintances, we should hold some comfort. Because Guru, you're getting it even from like the environment where you wouldn't expect it. Yeah, but yeah, you're right. Getting to a really good bit of his sadhana.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Yogananda often goes to Divine Mother. We've talked about it before in previous episodes. That's his go-to, isn't it? He's really very close to the Divine Mother. Energy, and he says, "Merciful Mother of the universe, teach me thyself through visions, or through a guru sent by thee." And quite simple and beautiful, again, and very poetic, Yogananda tends to be. And he says he spent hours on this, and he was sobbing, playing with no response. And then suddenly he felt that his bodily, he was uplifted through a sphere uncircumscribed. And so we can imagine this sort of translucent sphere around him of sorts, and that he felt lifted in this, or at least a bit more light, you could say. You could maybe interpret it as well, but maybe quite literally lifted as well. I don't know. Correct?
This is an emphasis on how Guruji advises us to pray and to meditate, like with like real hardcore yearning. And in the past chapter, I think, or episodes, he said, I vouchsafe to pray to God until I heard the response, right? So these are like essentially saying that he's not going to get up until he gets an answer one way or the other. And then like that's really hard to do, isn't it? So the teaching is like, I think he's written this in various books, is that God won't respond until he knows that you want him and him alone, God alone, essentially. So you're done with all these other, things in life, and you want God, and that's when you'll respond if you go to him with that yearning. And in Man's Eternal Quest, I found a small reading on this. I don't know, Chris, if it's appropriate to read it now.
Sure.
Yeah, it's in the chapter The Infinite Nature of God, and this section is entitled Give God First Place in Your Heart, and it's, it reads, wherever your mind is, that is where you will spend your time. What if God had not given you the power to play or read or work? You could do nothing. So he should come first in your life. God knows what is in your heart. Give him first place there. The only way to catch God is by love. Meditate upon him and then deeply pray. Lord, I cannot live without you. You are the power behind my consciousness. I love you. Reveal yourself to me. When you give up sleep to meditate upon him, when you forsake selfishness and cry because of his suffering in your brothers, he will come to you. When you actually sacrifice for him, he is caught in the net of your love. Nothing else can capture him.
Yeah, it's quite frequently said by Yogananda about the power of prayer, isn't it? And it's something I think is, for me at very least, rarely utilized, or at least it's very much underutilized, power of prayer. Now, maybe some subconscious or psychological analysis might say that, you know, you welcome suffering at times because you think you might deserve it or something, but actually, so we should be praying more for, you know, answers, and pray more for guidance, and, you know, going to turn to God first. And Yogananda's using it in putting into practice, really, and it gets an amazing response here. And it's quite clear, the response, because as he says, that whilst he's spending hours pleading and he's sobbing, he's crying, he suddenly felt this upliftment, and an answer came. Thy master cometh today. A divine womanly voice came from everywhere and nowhere. And so those four simple words must have been such an amazing response, like an amazing answer to receive. Because this is, you could argue, you know, Yogananda's key focus in his early life, isn't it? To find a guru to follow in some spiritual path and have a teacher. So this is the answer that he's been waiting for a very long time, and in a very intense way as well, not just in a passive way. This is truly what he's been seeking. So this answer must have been such a relief in some ways, such amazing news. And he describes it, you know, that the supernal experience was shattered by a shout from the definite locale, a young priest nicknamed Habu, was calling him from the downstairs kitchen. So I love the contrast, and it doesn't, you know, skip a beat between this absolutely, you know, supernal experience, as he says, this magical, wonderful, huge moment in his life that he's got this confirmation from Divine Mother, to bang straight down into reality, where there's, you know, Habu is calling him from downstairs and snapping him back into the sort of this reality, as it were.
And so he's had a beautiful spiritual experience where God, you know, essentially answers his prayer. And his prayer was, you know, merciful mother of the universe, teach me thyself through visions or through a guru sent by thee. That's a really good prayer, actually, isn't it? I'm going to probably use it one day when I'm doing a service next time. And so the answer, thy master cometh today, was like literally a direct response to the prayer. But the point I'm making is that he obviously meditated a lot, very hard, and he got the answer. So it was a beautiful experience. And then he's interrupted like really harshly by Habu. And so he's, you know, he's in his body is lifted to a sphere, uncircumscribed, and then he's pulled down. And I was wondering if you guys have ever, if you're meditating with other people in the household, and or if you're in some spiritual place and you're in a really good zone, and then life has its way of pulling you back down from that, you know, that sphere uncircumscribed. I don't know if you guys ever had that feeling, but it's so tough, isn't it, to when it happens, to retain your equipoise. And you know, because if you get angry at that moment, then you've lost something really, really beautiful that you've worked hard to get. And he says, doesn't he? He says, I said, on another day, you would have, you know, yelled at him. He said, another day, I might have replied impatiently. So even he didn't stoop to the level of anger in that moment, even though you know he's still essentially but this is before his divine realization.
You know, living in the jungle in Brazil, where I am, we have chickens. We had about 3 of them, but there's a lot of predators around. There's a lot of things that want to eat the chickens, and so we have to try to you know safeguard the chickens and sometimes scare away the predators if they come. And you know, everything from eating the eggs to eating the chickens. And so the chickens, if you've ever had chickens, they're very loud and noisy, and they make a lot of racket. So sometimes it's like the boy who cried wolf, wolf. So sometimes I run there and something there, and I'm able to scare the thing away and save the chickens. Sometimes I go there and there's nothing there. The chickens are just being noisy. So if I'm meditating and I hear the chickens going wild, that is me getting snapped back into the reality. So I have this all the time. And, you know, that's the reality of living essentially on what is a farm of sorts. And, you know, I welcome the plugging of the ears and blocking out the senses and, you know, trying to really go interiorize. Like, that's especially important for me here, because otherwise there are a lot of distractions in all sorts of forms, especially here.
By Yogananda in this case, he was actually praying to Divine Mother to intervene in life for him, right? To make a change to his life. And he couldn't have asked for a quicker, like he got this divine response, and he got this response in life as well. So maybe the only thing that I would have maybe had is that I wouldn't have understood right that second that this guy calling me is actually Divine Mother putting me on my way to my guru. But he might have, because he was maybe more in tune and very used to those kind of things to happen.
Yeah. I thought about this actually with Habu. It's just a conduit for following what would you say is destiny of sorts. And Yogananda had, I wouldn't say been fight, he would not have been fighting fate, but he says here that Habu, whose name I tried to look up to see what it meant, I thought, oh, that's an interesting name, but all I could find was large venomous snake, and I think that was some kind of Japanese interpretation, which I don't think was relevant. But anyway, you've got Habu here, who was calling Mukunda Dharana, and he actually says, enough meditation, you're needed for an errand. And so that's pretty blunt, isn't it? So they'd obviously had these conversations more than once, I imagine. That gives you that window of insight. And he says, Yogananda, that another day I might have replied impatiently, but now I've wiped my tear-swollen face and meekly obeyed the summons. And I thought to myself, okay, well, he's essentially saying, if he hadn't have had this glorious experience with Divine Mother and that confirmation, he might have put up a fight and tried to do what he thought was right in that time to continue meditation. But this goes to show that, you know, maybe there is a lot simply that we don't know, and that we may be fighting this idea of destiny or fate or how we call it. But there is a reading on destiny that I pulled out just on this topic that Mike can kindly read and Priyanka finish off. And then maybe we can get some insight as to what Yogananda's thoughts are on this.
Certainly. Every man who comes into the world carries within a general chart of his life, the details of which he fills in throughout his lifetime. The highways and some byways are already in the chart when he is born. These are traits he brings with him from previous incarnations. You are born with about 75% of your life predetermined by your past. you will make up the remaining 25%. If you yourself, through your own free choice and effort of will, do not determine what that 25% will be, the 75% will make the 25% for you, and you will become a puppet.
That is, you will be ruled absolutely by your past, by the influence and effects of your past tendencies. That is why spiritual training is vital. It takes into consideration not only the 75% of our lives that we already are, but also designates the methods to mold the brand new 25% that we ourselves are going to create by the exercise of our freedom.
And this is very different from the idea of fate, the idea that, you know, we don't have this control, this 25% that I think can be very easily mixed up between fate and destiny, right? Yogananda says that there is no such thing as fate, that you make your own destiny, just as you both have read there, that God gives you the independence to shut out his power or let it in. You have more strength to overcome difficulties than you have troubles to overcome. You can remedy your mistakes because God has given you reason and will. First, you must make up your mind, then hold your will steady to your purpose until it is completed. Discipline yourself to develop your sleeping spiritual powers. Claim your divinity, unite your consciousness with God, and receive blessings direct from his hand. So there is a little bit of a moment here where I thought, wow, okay, there's Yogananda. He's going through this tumultuous time, this spiritual anguish. He's prayed to Divine Mother. He's got this answer. And he says he meekly obeys the summons. So even though he's, you know, had this amulet that's vanished, even though he's had this prayer answered from Divine Mother, he's still sort of meekly going along with it because it's tough. You know, he's still having to go through it. That's life, you know. And just thought, wow, it's a great lesson just to have faith, I think, in destiny, but use the will, as Yogananda is doing, to pray to get the answers and kind of live that life as consciously as you can. So yeah, some nice little insights in there for us from Yogananda. And we have the long wait then, which is finally over. And there's a lovely scene that's depicted for us that he's together with his with Habu. He sets out for a distant marketplace in the Bengali section of Benares. And he was saying about, you know, how the ungentle Indian sun was not yet in the zenith. They made their way around a bazaar doing purchases. So he was pushing his way through this colorful medley of housewives, guides, priests, simply clad widows, dignified Brahmins, and ubiquitous holy bulls. And it really paints that lovely scene of a busy sort of marketplace in India, Priyank.
Indeed. I mean, I'm in such a location right now. I'm in a place called Vrindavan, which is where Krishna spent his childhood. And the pastimes with the gopis and the dancing was that. And interestingly, this place is called the City of Widows, other than all the other Krishna things that are related to it. And that's because widows in India, a lot of them leave when their responsibilities are over, especially when their husband has passed away. They would leave and become kind of renunciants, and a lot of them come to here where Krishna, and then hence they devote their lives to Krishna and service. And so you'll see widows across India, actually, after they've gone going through this phase of life. In this section, he mentions simply clad widows. So then they'll start dressing and behaving like very, you know, simply in like a meek way. And so in lots of parts of India, like in my part of India, in Gujarat, they wear like a navy blue, a dark navy blue, black color, or a very dark red color. So then not only do they behave that way because of their dress, and everyone knows the reason that they're behaving that way. So there's a bit of significance to that that perhaps readers may not have known about.
No, I definitely wouldn't have known about it. And it's a tradition, and it's kept all these years. This is what this is 1910 when Guruji met.
Both my grandmothers did this when their husbands passed away, and all the way up to their life, end of their lives. So like both my grandmothers passed away only 15 years ago, and both of them had this way of living at the end till the end of their lives, and they were from different parts of Gujarat essentially, so they're not from exactly the same part, so it's a commonplace.
Is it a sign of respect of having served your husband, and then you don't serve another, or just to understand?
No, it's not that. Nothing. It's about essentially living a very frugal and simple life from that forward, and hence your service was initially to your husband, and now it's to God essentially. I think that's the theory or the culture.
Yeah. No, it's really nice to hear, and it's funny because the tradition has kept, and one of the points that Yogananda is making, really, that he joined this Dayananda's hermitage, that they were a secular organization that was purposed to try to maintain sort of Hindu practices, traditions, and maybe we have them to thank in some way for the maintenance of the upholding the Eastern tradition in India versus the Western influence at the time, that there was a battle between the two. So very, very interesting.
Yeah. And remember, he was in Varanasi, right? So it's a very spiritual place, and quite similar to here, where I am right now in Vrindavan. So everything that he's described here, I'm experiencing firsthand. So for example, the colorful medley of housewives, that's commonplace in India. One of the things that most people love about India is the celebration of color. There's never a dull color in like a sari or things like that. It's always multicolored, isn't it? Especially when you're out and about, guides, priests. I was just accosted by a priest today and a guide that said, "Oh, he'll take me through various parts of the temple and explain things," and you'll just get harassed by so many people. And then so that's the colourful medley of wives and the simply clad widows is like the equal and opposite. And then he says dignified Brahmins, which I've mentioned. But then he also said ubiquitous holy bulls. And the one thing about Vrindavan and Varanasi is they're like really ancient towns, and like there's houses are like really compressed, so like the alleyways are really, really narrow. And he says ubiquitous holy bulls, so most parts of India have this, but it's more prominent in these places because you'll just like today I was walking along and like just right next to me, I expected my wife next to me, but she'd got caught up behind, and there was a massive bull that was just, well, I could just see the tip of its nose just walking to my side, and I just like jumped out the window, out of the way. But there's nowhere to jump because some of the alleyways are like 1-2 meters apart. And I remember brother Vishwananda, who was in London recently, he said the same thing. Like when he was in Varanasi recently, he was going through these narrow alleyways, and then if a bull's coming, it doesn't stop for you, it's walking through, so you have to like go up against the wall to let the bull through. And I can now know what he was talking about.
Wow, so cool. Very different from the scenes that I grew up in Northern Ireland, but love fun.
You have bulls there, Chris.
We've got plenty of cars, plenty of bulls. Yeah, we do. I live in the countryside as well, so probably see more than most, but not in a one-on-one robbing pasture in an alleyway type intimate relationship. Very cool. Okay, so then sorry, Prank, did you want, you didn't want to continue that?
No.
So Habu and young Mukunda, then they were moving on through these scenes, and it, this part reminded me. So he says he's turned his head to survey a narrow, inconspicuous lane. And it reminded me of the part earlier in the autobiography of a yogi when younger Mukunda was going on these trips. And, you know, when he was on trips in cities, he would be looking down every street lane, looking for his guru, sort of tirelessly. You know, it was always on his mind. He was always looking to see, you know, am I going to find him here? Am I going to find him here? And it never really happened. So I kind of thought, wow, okay, well, here he is. He's maybe still subconsciously doing this. And we're about to see, you know, about to see what actually happens. But down this inconspicuous lane, a Christ-like man, as Yogananda describes him, is there in ochre robes of Swami, of a Swami, and he stood motionless at the end of the lane. So he says that instantly and anciently familiar he seemed. For a trice my gaze fed hungrily, then doubt assailed me. So he's moving busily through these streets, and you know, he spots this Christ-like man standing motionless. You know, that it looks like they locked gaze, but he was doubtful. So, you know, he wasn't sure initially, Priyank.
It's a battle of intuition versus what's that word? Doubt. When doubt creeps in. So he intuitively knew that serious, the direction he was looking at, what he was seeing was serious. And then the doubt of all those past, as Chris mentioned, all those past experiences of him hungrily looking around for his guru, then obviously he doesn't have much hope at this stage, even though Divine Mother told him that she would find him, but he's got all these years or decade of past hurt. So that's like the habit of hurt, and the way that forces its way in, into your thinking, even at that moment, even though Divine Mother has told you it's going to happen, that's like gets pushed to the side, and then this doubt like takes over, this such as Maya.
Yeah. It's almost like he wasn't expecting it to happen. Like it caught him a bit off guard. And then, you know, we live in a society, so you don't want to be a person who's staring or seen staring or something, right? So maybe he just thought, okay, I'm already staring at this person for like 5 seconds. I should probably keep moving. And then it goes out of his mind again, right? It's not like it persists there. It's just, there's something, and then he keeps moving.
Something that you should you should know, in India, like, and in the West, the concept of like the rudeness of someone staring at you isn't such a thing. So so this was not out of him thinking it's rude that I'm staring at someone. It's purely that it's just, you know, dreamer walk on. He says it later, right? Dreamer walk on. It's not, he's going to think I'm being weird. So like you'll walk, if a Westerner walks in India, or anyone unusual walks in these narrow streets that where I am in quite right now, they'll get stared at. And it's, and in the concept of people, the locals thinking, oh, this is a bit rude for me to stare, is not a thing. They'll stare because it's a strange and unusual occurrence. That's only a Western paradigm, which is probably slowly coming into India, but it isn't in the majority of the cases. It's not there.
Don't take it personal.
Yeah.
You're getting stared at by somebody when you travel. Yeah, he does say that consciously to himself, you know, so it's very strong. You know, Maya delusion says, you are confusing this wandering monk with someone known to you. I thought, dreamer, walk on. So yeah, really, really powerful moment, isn't it? That he finally meets Sri Yukteswar. He finally sees, sets eyes on him in the flesh, and he says, dreamer, walk on. However, as we're going to see, that that was not going to be the end of it, Craig, before jumping to this.
Yeah, this dreamer walk on is, for some reason, it really hits a nerve, the way he's written that right after the line, "You're confusing this monk, you know, someone known to you, dreamer walk on," because how many, it's like it becomes a cliche, isn't it, the number of times that you think that, oh, this is going to be a really significant person in your life, or this this is a really important moment in your life, it becomes like you probably overuse it, and then when you have this intuitive moment, such as what Guruji had when he saw this face that he later is going to describe that he recognized, that again, that doubt comes in and you think you're a dreamer. He's calling himself a dreamer, right? So it's really a calling for, even though you've met on a million times, keep that faith, because that one time, it only takes one time to be right, and that could be the most important time. If you know what I mean.
Yeah. It's probably a good lesson.
Keep the faith.
Yeah, and Yogananda here, I guess he has some divine intervention. So, you know, he really does walk off. You know, he does literally walk on. He does succumb to this delusion. However, after 10 minutes, he says he felt a heavy numbness in his feet, as though turned to stone. They were unable to carry him any further. So, laboriously, I turned around. His feet regained normality. I faced in the opposite direction again, and the curious weight oppressed me. So he was sort of trying to wrestle even with this supernatural, metaphysical, I don't know how you would describe it, this moment that he was experiencing. The amulet, the divine message from Divine Mother, you know, him almost recognizing his guru, and then to this moment where he can't really walk in one direction. You know, he turns and walks, so he can walk that way a bit better, and turns the other way and he can't walk that way. And so this must be slowly dawning on him, really, what's happening here. But I still think he didn't do it instantly, did it? He was still trying to figure out what was going on.
Two things, actually. One thing is that he says here, after 10 minutes. Now, 10 minutes, I know they were shopping through the mall and stuff, but that's a long time. So we can conjecture about what actually happened in those 10 minutes. It might be a bit fun, because you can imagine Habu and Mukunda doing their thing, you know, doing their errands, and Mukunda having this thing in the back of his mind, you know, Divine Mother saying this, and you have this experience, but he's walked on, essentially. But he's doing his own thing, right? He's doing the errands. But Sri Yukteswar, you can imagine, is seen him. He's seen the drama that's about to play. He probably knows what's going to happen, that he's coming. Obviously, this is the disciple that's going to lead my ashram, etc., and take the message to the West that Babaji promised me. So he's seen the whole scene, right, from start to finish, probably. But in those 10 minutes, he's probably thinking, or he's probably working out, what is the best way for this moment to happen? And he's working it out. And he obviously, you know, it's such an important moment, this, in the autobiography of a yogi, as we mentioned, the top five moments. So in these 10 minutes, I think Sri Yukteswar is putting all these pieces together and making this moment as important as it's going to be for this book and to all of us disciples of Sri Yukteswar and Mahansa Yogananda, of course. But that's one point. Second point was something that Mike pointed out whilst we were doing the podcast on the Awake, the Life of Yogananda. In this case, his legs stopped him from walking in the wrong direction, or that his legs were stuck from walking one way. But later on in the book, when he meets Babaji, he doesn't want him to follow him, so he stops him from moving, even if it is in the right direction. So it's an interesting parallel. I think, Mike, you can explain it better than me, but that was a cool thing that you noted in the previous podcast.
Yeah, you did well. That the saints, sometimes they want you to follow them, sometimes not. Do you think Shiv Tetra maybe gave Yogananda some time to come back by himself, and then he was like, oh, forget it. I just need to intervene here.
a bit of a roll of the eyes, like, oh, okay, maybe.
Let's make him stop.
thought myself that, you know, the cities, the power of the cities, that Gariyama, is that how Gariyama? Is that how you pronounce that correct? The ability to become heavy or dense, maybe that can be used not just on yourself but on others. So maybe he's, you know, showing both Yogananda and us, you know, this power and revealing that.
Well, Sri Yukteswar kind of does it in the chapter, the cauliflower robbery, when he, you know, that insane man, he plants the seed, like he stops Mukunda from like walking towards him and stopping him, and that madman, and he plants that seed in that that crazy man's head to go find those prized cauliflowers. So in that scene, he stops Mukunda and everyone else from. And they watch the scene, and they actually physically see Sri Yukteswar intercede with that crazy man. And this is something probably similar happening, but we don't get to see that side of it on this occasion. What's actually happening in Sri Yukteswar's mind when he's stopping Mukunda from walking away?
Yeah, well, we know the penny dropped eventually, certainly. We don't know exactly how long this went on for, this moment in time when he was turning and he was realizing that he couldn't walk in one direction versus the other. But we know the penny dropped, and he says that the saint is magnetically drawing me to him. So that's how he describes it, isn't, you know, a magnet, which I think is really interesting language, Mike.
Yeah, so at this point, he's probably still blocks away from the saint, but he knew it's him and he calls him saint. So we kind of thought earlier that he just walked on and it was out of his mind, but it was somewhere in the back of his mind. He was probably still thinking, well, who was this person? Maybe, was there something special going on? Should I go back? I feel like he's not mentioning it, but it might have been conflicted the whole time. And then when he had to suddenly walk backwards, he knew this must have been because of the person I just saw in the alleyway.
And the other thing about the magnet magnetically drawing him to him is that the Guruji often uses the analogy of a magnetic needle, that when it becomes, like, you know, when it's put in front of a magnet, it becomes like stuck facing north and it doesn't move. And he says, like we should also become like that, become immovably fixed on the North Star of soul bliss, he calls it in the Bhagavad Gita, or God Talks with Arjuna.
Yeah, and he used similar language, I think, to describe him being able to detect the soul of a previously dead boy from his school, right?
Kashi.
Kashi, yeah. You said essentially he was using it kind of like a pointer, like a almost like a radar, or, you know, and trying to detect where this soul was. So yeah, really, really interesting language here. And he said that with this thought, then that he this is quite funny. You could see this done in a very comical way. It was reenacted, right? He heaped parcels, all the shopping just got heaped into the arms of Habu. He was probably a bit confused at this point, but Habu had been observing this erratic footwork with amazement and burst into laughter. And he said, what ails you? Are you crazy? So here, you know, he's chuckling away. And what kind of struck me about this moment is, you know, you might say this is a miracle, however you describe what's going on here. It probably just depends on your ability to understand what's really going on, but you're seeing something that is really miraculous in a sense, but looks completely daft to, you know, the untrained eye, or, you know, he's not attuned to what really is going on in that moment. And so how the miraculous can seem, you know, crazy It's just two different perspectives and ability to attune your attunement with this wonderful, miraculous life itself. So I just thought that the spiritual path is kind of like that, with sort of some of the world is sees it as crazy, but yet they don't quite understand because of their attunement. But even here, we have a spiritual devotee is not quite understanding what's going on with Mukunda. Like,
did you guys ever think why this had to happen this way? Because Sri Yukteswar could have just dropped by Dayananda's ashram, right, and say, "Hey, Mukunda, how's it going?" You know, and could have met like this, but it had to be that Mukunda came to him, right? I feel like that's somehow significant. And even if it, from this description, it seems like that it must have looked like someone else took control of Mukunda's body and made his body move that way. But somehow it was important that he came back to him. He would also not run after him, for example. Yeah.
He was, I think he was on the end of his tether, wasn't he, with this Dayananda episode. And only when the disciple is ready does the guru appear, right? And so the disciple in this case is still, Mukunda is still looking in Dayananda's direction and in this ashram life and all the other things he's done, like running away to the Himalayas. But now I think he's in his mind, you know, he's having so much trouble with this ashram and he's realized it's not where he wants to be, and he's pray to Divine Mother, and then now Sri Yukteswar, now is the time. So I think it all actually depended on Mukunda. So Sri Yukteswar, God can intervene whenever he wishes for us, right? But he doesn't. He lets us choose when we want to go toward him. That's the whole drama and the purpose of free will, as it were.
I did think about this actually, because Divine Mother did say in the answer that thy master cometh today. So she's actually saying that the master's coming, the way I read it, to you in a sense. And Swami Sri Yukteswar wasn't a man of Varanasi, of Benares. He was of Sarampurya. If I'm saying that,
pronounced and so, Puri, yeah, and he had Nashram and Puri,
yeah. And Nashram Puri, yeah, and Lahiri Mahashaya was the one that was in Varanasi, so he must have been then visiting in 1910 Lahiri Mahashaya.
No, he was visiting his mother, I think he told him.
He was visiting his mother, yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was visiting his old mother, yeah,
yeah. Okay.
Swami Sri, Lahiri Mahashaya had passed away before then.
Of course, okay, yeah, thanks. Well,
good. Taken his Mahasamadhi by then.
Okay, yeah, thanks. Because I was a little bit confused, like, what was he doing? What was he actually doing there? Because he was in, he should be in Sarampur, you know? So, you know, he was definitely sent this guru to be where he was himself in Benares at the time in Varanasi. So yeah, what a wonderful sort of moment that we can read into and learn from. But essentially, he's always been tapped on the shoulder here by his colleague, Habu, saying that he was essentially crazy. Which in that moment, maybe if he was a bit weaker, he wasn't that much in tune. He might have sort of said, yeah, maybe, you know, maybe I am a bit crazy or something. But no, he said with tumultuous emotion, he was prevented from retorting to Habu, and he suddenly sped away. So he was quite set on exactly what he needed to do by that point.
Brilliant. Yeah, so this is the second time then he stops himself from retorting. So here he says, my tumultuous emotion prevented any retort, but equally, so he's had this lovely realization that this, you know, this is his guru essentially, and he's drawing him to him, And that is obviously a very beautiful moment in his young life. And he doesn't want to sully this moment by anger or retort. So this is the second time that we're getting the same lesson. You know, when we have that beautiful moment with God, nothing essentially should allow you, nothing, you shouldn't allow anything to take you down from that state.
I read that slightly differently. I when I read this, I felt Anita's tumultuous emotion. I felt like he was not knowing what was going on, really. And that's why he didn't retort, because Mukunda is someone, if you say something to him, he would always retort. He would not a pushover kind of person. And then, but he couldn't, because he was somehow busy with like, what's happening with my body? I'm walking this way. I don't even know why. And maybe the other thought is, I might be the saint. Is he my guru or what's going on? Mm. So he was in he had his mind completely focused on something else, but I'm not sure if it was like a state of elevation or if it was a state of distress and what's going on.
Well, we know merely, you would say, even moments, relatively speaking, moments ago, he was in his attic praying and getting an answer from Divine Mother, right? And he was sobbing. He was there for hours. So that was a very heightened emotional state that he was already in. So I don't think maybe that clears for a while, right? And he was already in this state. He was in amongst, you know, doing chores that he probably didn't want to do. You know, he would be going hunting for his guru and doing the meditations. But so yeah, I mean, he was already in this state of emotional state. So whether he'd actually sort of calmed from that or not, I don't know. He's clearly back into this tumultuous emotional state, and he did silently sped away. Maybe my dad says, the less said, the easier mended. So, you know, less said, easier mended here to Abu, and he retraced his steps through the wing shod, as he says, through wing shod, he reached the narrow lane, and he glanced quickly down the lane, and it revealed the quiet figure steadily gazing in his direction. And he then said, a few eager steps and I was at his feet. And what a lovely part of rejoice sort of part in the book, where, as I said, you know, this has been his, you would say, his life goal up until this point, really, that he had been seeking his guru. He wanted to run away to the Himalayas and, you know, seek out these great ones, and they'd appear to him in visions, and hearing Mahashayad, obviously, you know, being a great standing part of his life. And he had somewhat reluctantly agreed to, you know, follow a slightly different path than, you know, going off to the Himalayas. And here he is finally reunited with Sri Yukteswar in 1910 in Banaras or Varanasi. In a, you know, not in a, as you said, Mike, like, you kind of wonder how things are done and why and all the rest of it. And this wasn't in some grandiose, you know, setting. It was in an alleyway, like in a sort of side street, very intimate moment between the two of them. And that's really what we're going to go into in the next episode in a lot more detail, which is this beautiful, very moving, memorable moment between the two of them that I think we can all share in that feeling, having met, been maybe reunited with Yogananda in his lifetime, using the minute as our guru. So I think it's a very relatable moment, I think, for all of us, but one that we share in the emotions and the beauty so that's where we'll leave it today, really, on this moment. There's a cliffhanger, you know, what exactly will happen next time. We'll soon find out. I'm sure the readers, you know, can either read on or they know already. But Mike?
All right. I was actually going to spoil a little bit, but maybe I'll leave it to Priyank to tease a little bit.
I can't. You can't possibly tease. It's going to be so hard to do the next episode, isn't
it? Yeah.
I don't know how.
I was just going to say, yeah. I was just going to say that you think now you would think they live happily ever after, but there's still some back and forth.
I was reading a little bit about Sri Yukteswar, you know, in sort of preparation for this episode, next episodes. And we know that Sri Yukteswar didn't have a lot of disciples. You know, it had a handful, maybe just a few. And it was Yogananda himself that said that it was really because of the disciplinarian style that he had was unbearable for most, that he really put people through through their, you know, through a lot in their spiritual discipline. So yeah, what you said there, Mike, is definitely true. You know, this is just the beginning for Mukunda. And he was going to go through from here on a spiritual discipline that not many could, you know, not many would. So yeah, all the journey thereafter is about to unfold, and this is just the beginning, really, for the two of them. So that really is it in summary of this episode. Yogananda is back at the feet of his guru, and then we're going to delve into in the next episode. Next episode's exactly what is said between them, or lack thereof, we'll look forward to going into that in a bit more detail. But anything that you chaps would want to cover off before we close for the episode? Anything that we missed? Sure, something. But we'll maybe leave that to the listeners in the audience. So there is a theme really throughout the autobiography of Yogi, a prayer that we can play very quickly. It's 59 seconds to be exact. Prayer that Yogananda himself has said and is recorded. And I thought maybe it's a nice way to close it off, because you can really feel the soul prayer that Yogananda talks about, this method of prayer that we should all incorporate, with feeling coming from the depths of your soul, the emotion. So we'll play this and we'll sign off for the day. So thanks very much for joining us, Jai Guru.
Jai Guru.
Will you all pray with me? Heavenly Father,
Jesus Christ.
Babaji Krishna. Lahari Mahashai, Sri Yukteswar Ji, Guru Preceptor, Saints of all religions, I bow to you all. Heavenly Father, may thy love shine forever on the sanctuary of our devotion, and may I be able to awaken thy love in all true hearts. And dear ones, once more the blessing of God and his light surcharges you, and go left, right, front, behind, north, south, east, west, everywhere you go, live God. Practice your Kriya, be intoxicated with that communion with the Spirit, and whoever shall see your eyes shall change.